Today on the 21st show, the campaign to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois after Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election. We'll have the eighth in our series of conversations. Republican Casey Chlebek emigrated with his family from Poland in the 1960s. For decades, he worked in information technologies. Now he runs a real estate management business. We'll talk with him about domestic policy, foreign affairs, and politics in an era dominated by President Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. We also want to put your questions to the candidate, so you can call us throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey with Casey Chlebek for the hour today on the 21st show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we are almost halfway through interviewing the entire field of candidates, Democrats and Republicans, seeking Illinois' U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Dick Durbin. Today, another one of the half dozen Republicans running in this primary. Casey Chlebek is from Poland originally. He was born and raised there. In the days after graduating high school, he and his mother and brother emigrated to Chicago, where his father was. He went to Harold Washington College, one of the community colleges there, for a couple of years, then transferred to the University of Illinois. He graduated from there in 1971, and from there he went into the field of information technology. In more recent years, he shifted his focus to real estate. He founded and runs a business called C&J Realty Management. This is his third time running for United States Senate. He came in fifth in 2020 in the Republican primary. Mark Curran earned the party's nomination that year, lost to Dick Durbin. In 2022, he tried again, finished in fourth with the nomination going to Kathy Salvey. She lost the general election to Senator Tammy Duckworth. Casey Chlebek joins us now in studio in Urbana for the hour. Welcome to the 21st show.
Thank you for inviting me, and welcome all of Illinois. I am Casey Chlebek, and I am running for U.S. Senate. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your airwaves and to speak across Illinois.
Yeah, and let me invite anyone who is listening to us. You can join us today. We have a lot to get through. We're going to be talking about domestic policy, foreign policy, and the candidate's background. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. Let's start with your earlier life. What was it like growing up in Poland?
Well, I tell you, that was a very, truthful experience. Why? Because I, being raised on that communist system, I noticed how the system works, what it does for the people, what it does against the people. So this is a unique experience that I have and bring to the United States, and I can make people aware of the dangers of the system itself, okay?
What were some of the, give me an example of something that you experienced that left you with a negative feeling towards the government system in Poland?
Well, first of all, you had to participate in a lot of activities that you had no interest in because the propaganda was ever present, okay? You were restricted of, you know, where you want to go, you want to be. Definitely, there was curtailed on. And as being raised in a farm, we were also restricted in many respects, of, you know, how our produce, you know, is being distributed. And we had only, you know, selected ways of competing with, you know, people around.
Did you have a career path in mind or set for you if you had stayed?
Well, thank you very much for asking that, because I actually did. And my initial idea was actually go into architecture. There are quite a few architects, including even my daughter and other Chlebeks. I'm not. When I came here, actually undertook engineering, okay, But when I graduated, I could not find a job as an engineer in 1972. It was a difficult time. But I knew half a dozen of computer languages. I called Implement Agency, and wow, all of a sudden, out of three, two gave me, you know, possibility of joining them in, at that time, data processing. Today we called IT. All my professional life, all my career was in IT.
We're talking like Fortran, COBOL? What are we talking
about? It was Fortran, COBOL, PO1, assembler. But actually, my breakthrough was when I got a job at the University of Illinois when I was working for Polish researchers I had to translate his work, which was written in Algol, that's a scientific language used in Europe, into Fortran. So that was my, you know, first job, actually, at the university.
Translating computer code.
Translating computer code. Actually, I even found a problem he had with his thesis, because he did not, or programmer did not account for boundary conditions. Hmm. And I found it, and I told him, look, this is why you don't have one minima, you have multiple minima sometimes, because you don't have employee the boundary condition. Being an engineer, I noticed that there was a problem with the algorithm, the way it was written. So just a little information, you know, that it actually engineering kind of helped me out, actually, initially when I started as a programmer.
So you're a teenager when you come here. What was the experience like? How easy was it for you and your family, to the extent you know about what your folks went through, to come here?
Well, first of all, because it was my uncle that invited us, or his brother, we were not on the expedited fashion coming. We had to wait. So that process took like 5 years altogether before we finally got our passports. So it took a long time, but everything was done by the book legally. And I actually tell you, I admired that aspect of it, because it is done with a very professional manner, and everything was accounted for. Even my health condition, everything was looked at, you know. So that's how I believe immigration should be handled as well. So, and if I can say what else was kind of contributing to this is the fact that I am at that moment in my life, I also saw that America is a beacon that you are longing for. And that was driving force, actually, not just for my family, but for myself as well. And I have to attest to it that finally I achieved that American dream, because I was so successful, I can run today for you. And actually, more above that, I decided to run pro bono publico, for public good, for free. Yeah, so it's been very inspiring moment in my life when I decided, or my family decided for me, to move to the United States, and I never looked back.
If you're just joining us, it's the 21st show. We are speaking with Casey Halebik, who is a candidate for United States Senate. He's running in the Republican primary, a field of six people, all seeking to be the person who runs in the general election to succeed Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, who is not seeking re-election after five terms in the U.S. Senate. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. So a lot of people, when they retire from their main career in life, take up fishing or golf. Why do you want to be a United States Senator?
Well, as I indicated before, I have this wonderful experience, which taught me about the communism itself. But as one would put it, you know, in some countries, communism was killing people with bullets. Here it's done a little differently. Is it the ideology that's being employed? And it has been in the works for over 100 years, started with Frankfurt Schule in Germany. And I noticed that, and how well it is managed, well done, looks beautiful on the surface. But under the surface, it actually is a very corrosive ideology, toxic ideology, which actually, in the end, it destroys not just minds of our young generation, but also kills the family. And I thought that this was probably part of it that I should explain. Also, as a success, I told you, I thought that I am, you know, a little bit enriched, and I can afford to spend that time with the people and for the benefit of the country, dedicate my time. I look at it also, by way of example, from President Trump, and also a little bit from history, because in ancient Rome, emperor and the senators were not working, were not paid. Their work was pro bono publico, was for free, because everybody understood that they are doing something honorable and dignified for the country. And I feel the same way in this position. And also, at the end, politics should not be, or running as a senator, should not be about politics, power, or parties. It should be about people. Because in the end of the day, it is for the people. it is by the people that we can manage our society better and give it a better outlook for the future. If we forget that at the bottom of all this equation are the people, then we are in a different place. But I hope that it be understood. And that's why I am running for the United States Senator.
So you mentioned this idea that, and I don't want to characterize it. Say more about that. This idea you think is, I can't remember the term you use, infected or affecting the minds of young people today. Say more.
Okay. Let's understand the concept of the cultural Marxism. Well, initially,
just so people, in case they didn't catch that, cultural Marxism is what you're talking about. That's the
that
phrase.
That's
correct. Define that for us.
Cultural Marxism means that today's communist ideology does not work with the revolution. It works by actually culturally changing the mind of people. We could use a better term, brainwashing, with a very beautiful, actually. It's, if you look at this ideology, it doesn't. No one can probably find much wrong with it, but in the end of it, it actually amounts to going in a totally different direction, dissolving the family issue, dissolving the sometimes even the humanity concept itself. When you are told that, don't worry about what you're going to be, girl or boy, when you're 18, you decide. So this is the essence of a cultural Marxism, bringing to your mind a different aspect of fight to the people. Don't fight with the bullets. Fight with the idea. And they were very successful at it, I have to admit. They worked on it for 100 years by abandoning the proletariat and finally went to the minds of the people. That's the bottom line.
So this is the idea, what you're saying here. And I think this is something where if you're not sort of steeped in certain media institutions in America, you may not follow this as clearly. But the idea is the Frankfurt School, which was the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt,
That's
Germany.
Correct.
There are people who fled the Nazis. Feared persecution.
1933.
Yeah, and come to America, and then
and
then
what? University. That's right.
And then what?
And then what? And I want to admit that actually that idea spread like wildfire, not just across the United States, but actually across the world. This is a very incisive ideology. No one can deny that. So they spread this idea initially at the highest level of education, at the universities.
And this is critical theory, right? The idea
theory.
Of studying
initially was,
how power works.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Initially it was called critical race theory, CRT. But people didn't like the race issue with it, so they called it later critical theory. Okay, shorten it a little bit. Nowadays, we can call it maybe as woke or DEI, but this is the same concept. It's just a little differently worded to make sure it's more acceptable to the general public. So this is where it is. It is really designed for you to appreciate the greatness of the concept. But in the bottom line, it lasts as long as the money lasts. When it's done, it's over. You cannot find the system. Finding the system, it collapses. So, but the idea here is, it was designed to come or target people's minds, and actually that's why.
What are some examples of that? What are some examples of cultural Marxism at work in our society? Right? How do you see it?
Example can I give you? Cultural Marxism, at a school level, because it's probably easiest example, okay, to use cultural Marxism, okay? It designed to you to, for example, use concept of equity as that, you are all sharing, equally the produce of the society. There is no room for competition, no room for equality. It's the equity. Equity becomes the key word. So that's how it shows you that they are attempting to introduce it to a greater level and supposedly a greater good, one would think.
But how does that differ from like equal opportunity, which I think most Americans
would agree?
Equal
opportunity, it's designed more on across the lines of competition, whereas the equity, it's we just divide it. Okay, you maybe justly or unjustly, enrich yourself so much, maybe we should cut it. And although in this country they don't do it as much before, but in many countries when it implemented, that's how it was done. It was done the same that way in China and in Russia. And ultimately, it's done in more finesse way of accomplishing the same goal. Okay, and we have to be careful about it because, let's face it, capitalism is about competition, about markets, not about equally dividing it because we have it. Well, we happen to be a very rich country. We can afford to do it, and maybe a lot of people will not even notice that this is because of the fact that we are sharing a lot of wealth. Okay, but it lasts for so long. So that's where danger is, and as Margaret Thatcher said, it's all great and good until the money runs out.
It's all great and good until the money runs out. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation today. We are speaking with Casey Halebik, who is one of the six people running on the Republican side in the primary for United States Senator to fill the vacancy being created by Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election this year. There are additional 10 candidates on the Democratic side. We are endeavoring to talk with all of them. We've scheduled interviews with all but two of the 16 candidates here on the 21st show. We've had a bunch of those already. You can find our past conversations in this series at our website, which is 21stshow.org. Again, our guest today for the hour is Casey Halebik, who worked in information technology for much of his life after immigrating to the United States, emigrating from Poland, where he was born and raised. He's worked in real estate more recently. If you want to join us today, if you have questions, 800-222-9455 is the number. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will have more in this conversation. It's the 21st show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Casey Halebik, who is one of the Republicans running for his party's nomination for United States Senate to fill the vacancy being created by Dick Durbin's decision not to seek re-election this year. 800-222-9455 to join us today. 800-222-9455. All right, before the break, you've made a big part of your campaign this idea of warning of the dangers of what you call cultural Marxism. For anyone who's just tuning in, this is the idea that after the Nazis came to power in Germany, a number of people from Frankfurt, the Frankfurt School, there's a school there called School for Social Research, came to America. These people had studied the way power works, both in fascist and democratic countries. But since then, you think it's gone awry. It's spread ideas that are detrimental to America. One thing I want to, some people who are critical of this idea say, you know, aren't these just social changes that people don't like, right? There's been a civil rights movement over time, gay rights movement, women's rights movement. Those, you know, efforts took decades to build up acceptance in society of some of those ideas. And that it's not like a, you know, a plot by these German, you know, refugees who came to America. How do you respond to that, that this is not something that's like brainwashing people? This is something people have been, you know, come around to. This is an idea that people appreciate. Some of these changes.
There's no doubt that a lot of background from this stems from actually social changes, and to be honest, they were so smart. That's why they abandoned proletariat and it went to different groups, sometimes fringe groups even. But they thought that they may be a better anchor for this ideology. So they try to use every social group that they possibly can, even at their disadvantage, and give them protective power to sort of sell the idea. Because let's face it, ideas sometimes are very difficult to sell, but it's easiest way to sell to people that are probably the most disadvantaged and maybe even ostracized for some, you know, for some passion. So that's what's actually the skill, and that's why it is hard sometimes to make this distinction, because I don't deny some of these ideas that we are trying to, you know, blame them for actually originated as a social movement, okay? But is it, there's a limit where social movement moves on its own or where it is being cultivated by some groups, some elements that have alternate purpose. And that's where comes this finesse in their way they are approaching this problem. Because let's face it, we are always going to be faced with social aspects of fight or, you know, our position in society. But it, what makes a difference, what is the ultimate goal? Is there, you know, something that somebody is designing for us, or is it because we as a group, that specific group, wants to just accomplish, okay? So that's the difference. It's a very finely defined distinction between the two.
It's one thing to talk about cultural Marxism on a radio show or, you know, at a bar, wherever people want to talk about it. What would it mean? What are the policy implications of that? What would a United States senator do to try and prevent the spread of cultural Marxism?
Well, I would abandon, you know, a lot of curricula because they're not very, you know,
Ben, so you,
about
you would outlaw it, you mean?
Yeah, push it out because we probably need more to learn about our own history, our own culture, our own background, rather than trying to tell people, well, how wonderful the world is going to be. So this is probably the bottom line. And right now, this is almost ever present. It's under President Trump, it's kind of there's a little bit tightened, of course, but it's still effects of this 100-year efforts are paying off, and you can still see them in many academia. And it's almost sometimes at one point became like a perversive idea, and we have to stop that. Okay, so
how does that work with the First Amendment, right, which says Americans have freedom of speech and thought?
Well, that's glad you mentioned that because yes, you can advocate freedom of speech, but it's a different thing if you're advocating ideology that's subversive. So that's actually undertone of this process. It's not just the idea, oh, I don't like it because I'm not being paid well. I don't like it because I adjust against my own beliefs, my own religion. This is an idea of a subversive ideology, which is from a side, not from necessarily your own perspective, but it's being suggested via different ways, being it through media, being it through schooling. But it's done in a very, you know, shall we say, sophisticated way. I tell you, I admired the way they achieved that up to this point. And then we are waking up, and I was told, and it probably is the fact, that it was the pandemic, yeah, that actually made people aware, or parents aware, what the kids are being taught in a school. They woke up and said, wait a minute, this is not what I expected the school to teach. So the ideology is maybe what is a difference, makes a difference, versus your own wish to do something different. So speech your own way of thinking, that's a great. And then we should always admire, you know, because this is a very essential of the two amendments, you know, that we have to protect. But it's, if the ideology is behind it, that's a different goal.
Yeah. Okay. I'll leave listeners to make their own assessment of that. We're talking with Casey Halibek, who is a candidate for United States Senate on the Republican side. There are some other policy issues I think we can talk about. And I know you have talked about wanting to overhaul the immigration system of America. Tell me briefly, what is your main idea there?
Let me explain, because actually in my current cycle, I'm not concentrating actually on immigration or even safety and security, even though both of these platforms are valid and are in full force.
You're right. It was a video from 2020 that I watched where you talked about the plan to overhaul immigration. So
it is obviously
a very active issue right now, though.
But let me maybe slide from that issue to what we have right now. Because, yes, in 2022, that was like the most important and the most visible thing, this safety and security of people. And it was always immigration. Immigration still is. But what I did notice, though, that, yes, they are very relevant, but they are not felt the same way by entire society. It's only a certain segment of society, few immigration, if you're close to the border, or certain segments, few safety, where your neighborhood is in danger. But there are other aspects of domestic policies which around taxation where it affects everybody equally. So I came to the conclusion that I have to deliver something for the people. And that's why we came up with this idea of a seven pillar for Magna agenda. Magna, it means making America the greatest nation again.
Okay, and I can't help but notice that's similar to MAGA, the Make America Great Again.
I think it is similar, but no, it's more specific because MAGA may be a little bit of vague. It can be MAGA in, you can be great in anything, in sports or whatever. But this is the first great, make the country greatest again. What are the fundamentals that can bring us as people together and make us prosperous? So that's why we came up with this idea of seven pillars for domestic policy because Magna is domestic policy. Mula is foreign policy. So I would like to outline, but...
We will get to that. I do want to talk about some of your domestic policy points. But I am curious about, as somebody who immigrated here, how do you think about how our immigration system is functioning now?
I'm sorry I did not follow up on your initial question on immigration, because I indeed believe that we do need overhaul our 100-year-old immigration system. There's no doubt about it. And actually, in 22, I wrote an article in Spanish, how to solve this problem in order to make it easy and manageable, that not by actually invading, hordes of people our borders, but by good due process. And what I was suggesting, actually, sort of create around the world in countries that are interested in having their people immigrate to the United States, have a recruitment centers right there in those countries. And we provide them, some specific agencies designed for that purpose. I call it recruitment agencies. Provide them with list of the different jobs that we need, the quota they need to fill, and they can be managed right there and then to match what our needs are and to make sure that these people share our values. I don't see the solution by going to the border and then be processed and you don't know what to do with this person, and later you end up paying for a stay and et cetera. I see it differently. You do it outside of the country, and when you come to the border, you already have papers, and no one is asking you more questions about, what your status is.
What does that mean, share our values, you said?
Share values, it means that have the same concept of that is enshrined in our constitutional republic, that we as people are the ones that are in control and should be in control, and we should let our freedoms prosper, and we should prosper by way of using capitalism as a source, as a tool to make it happen. I know when every time you use the word capitalism, it's like a little sort of difficult word, not very, a lot of people feel comfortable, but it is a form of an economic system that so far has proven well. Yes, there are some issues, but you can always fine-tune it. But it is the cornerstone that they should be basing, not as just as freedom of equality, not equity, equality, but also our economic driving engine, which is basically still a capitalist system.
So if somebody believed in a different form of government, they would not be eligible to come in America?
Well, you have to define what is a different form of government. You know, if you come from, let's say, even from China, communist China, but if you're showing that you're inspired to our values, you should be, allowed to do that, okay? The fact that you were born like I was, and I was allowed to come in even though someone would criticize me as a communist.
Yeah,
and that's sometimes, right. And sometimes I was, by the fact that I just came from it. But you should be, this should not be a question of, I'm sorry, what system you're living, it is what value you are bringing to the country. That should be the bottom line of this, okay? So if we use this as a yardstick, we are in a good company.
What do you think of the way that, say, people from Venezuela who were fleeing a leftist government down there coming to America, and now many of them are being rounded up and sent back or sent to El Salvador into a gulag, essentially, there? How do you think of how the government is prosecuting that?
Very, very complicated question, but a very good question. But because I tell you, and it sort of revolves around the issue that when you let people in uncontrolled manner, just crossing the borders, wading through the river, it becomes a problem because you don't know what values they bring in, you don't know what the ultimate motives are, and you don't know sometimes even the governments, in the sense they are managing that process, maybe they are sending. But once you hear, you have to be a little bit more careful, I think, the way we approach this, because it could be easily said, well, you immigrated illegally, we are deporting you. But if somebody was here for 10 years, they established family, they are paying already, taxes, and they are, you could compare them almost like on an equal basis with any other citizen. You have to look at it a little differently, examine it almost case by case basis. Because I don't think it's the right thing to do when you just take people off the street, yank them out, and throw them out. I want to tell you this. My grandfather and grandmother came to the United States once, three times, the other one four. I'm not sure which one came. But no one was asked them, at that time, where are your papers, whatever. They were free to come. The times have changed, okay? We cannot afford to do that anymore. We have to control a little bit, who's coming and, of course, understand that it's also maybe a cost associated with it. So we have to also ensure that they will not be a burden to our society as well. These are a lot of complicated issues that go into it, but I don't subscribe to this blanket way of just, deporting people. But indeed, that process is long overdue.
What about agents wearing masks? Federal government agents wearing masks.
I'll be honest with you, I am taking a little bit back some of these procedures are done. And here's my take on it. Because some states have a little bit different issue, do it exercise a little differently. Florida, for example, they all state immediately if they issue have a problem, they relate it to the federal government. Well, true, immigration is federal issue, but I consider it totally federal issue when you are attacking the border. So when you do the border, it's totally federal issue. But once they are in, as it happened, not that anybody wanted it that way it happened, you have to employ a little bit different approach to this when you are part of a state already. And you know what I believe? If in order to justify, and wearing mask is probably overdone and sends a bad message. But in order to justify the purpose or the usage of the ice, in general, maybe we should have a bill designed before we even make that move. Before we make the move, to tell them you are, empowered with this rules or whatever to follow before you move into the society. Because I don't take it very lightly when we have actually citizens being killed, rightly or wrongly, but that's not a good message.
We need to take a break, but it actually sounds like you're advocating a similar position to some of the Democratic candidates we've talked to who say, there should be some sort of overhaul legislative fix to how ICE operates here in America. We're going to have to leave that teaser for when we come back after the break. If you want to join us today, we're going to get to some calls. 800-222-9455 is the number. We're talking with Casey Halibik, who is a candidate for United States Senate on the Republican side. Primary election coming up in March. Early voting will be happening very soon. Different times, different places in Illinois. More to come after a short break. It's the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Casey Halibik, who is a Republican candidate in the primary for United States Senate here in Illinois, one of six people running on that side of the aisle, one of 16 overall candidates. You can hear other conversations in our series of interviews with them at 21stshow.org. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. So before the break, I said what some will construe as fighting words, I'm sure, on the Republican side, which is sort of perhaps too flippantly comparing your view of some reforms, perhaps. I'm just trying to understand being needed with immigration and customs enforcement and the way it's being carried out now. Two American citizens have been killed in Minneapolis. What do you think should be the response of the United States Senate if you were in the Senate to what is happening right now?
I would advocate provide the passage of a bill, special bill for that purpose designed, that it gives the powers to the ICE, as an example, rather than just using it as a blanket old-style policy. Design it for this purpose so there's no question when they are moving that they can execute their job. Because, let's face it, President Trump is right now, I would think, almost believe it between rocket and hard place, he's trying to do something in a short time that was neglected, not, you know, just from Biden, but for decades it was neglected. And as I said, we have a 100-year-old system that needs to be overhauled. So we have to, at least at this moment, without overhauling the system, provide the agents that are in the field, especially across the country, with powers that everybody agrees to. That's why the Congress is designed for. That's what the Senate is for. That's what the Congress is for. And let's make sure that the bill is passed that identifies the scope of powers that they can execute. Because it may appear that this is like a they execute this at will, you know, in the different states, they approach it differently. And I told you before, you know, Florida has usually relies on referring the issue to the federal government. Illinois does not that. Actually, just recently said, stay out of Chicago, stay out of Illinois. Okay, that should not happen. We should, the agency should be empowered by passing a special purpose bill for that, to that effect, that when they go out, there's no question they are executing the authority and the actual will of the people. Okay, that's my approach. Okay, and that's probably we have lack of a cohesive approach to this, and we are trying to at sometimes, you know, maybe explain it from a perspective that may be differently interpreted by different people. Okay, I don't want to establish myself here as a Democratic candidate, you know. But I am still see that at the bottom of it, we have to be careful how people are being approached and treated in this process, okay? And if we do pass a special purpose bill, you know, designed with the powers that they will be allowed to move in, they will be non-issue. They can just do their job instead of having massive protests as it is. This is not called for. Why, you know, and we look as a country, we don't look well outside the world because it shows that we have some cracks in the system, and we can stop that. We didn't have to go that, you know, that route.
Yeah. All right. I want to take a call. We have Corey calling from Springfield. Corey, this is, I believe you want to go back to the idea of the cultural Marxism we were talking about earlier. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah. I was just, you know, if a group of academics fleeing genocide wrote books and taught students and some of those ideas later became influential, Isn't that just how intellectual history works, or are you actually claiming there was a coordinated conspiracy?
I actually do believe that that's how it was designed, and the purpose was, as I said initially, use proletariat to overthrow the regimes, oppressive regimes, and later they found out by Bolshevik Revolution 1917, it doesn't work. Proletariat is not willing to fight for the cause and die, so they said, well, we are changing our mission and let's do it differently, let's go and attack the brains. So they developed, and that was Frankfurter Schule mission, to develop that program. And they later, in 1933, they moved to United States, to Columbia University, and it spread like wildfire across the United States and the world. But yes, it is designed by the institution to manage it on institutional level, and that's why it was everywhere in our educational system, starting with the highest education first.
And that is the same, like, if it's a deliberate plot, like, that's not intellectual history, that's a conspiracy theory. Like, that same conspiracy theory
Wait a minute, I'm sorry, I was stopping you, because you're looking at a slogan, it's not proven, it's a conspiracy. What's a conspiratory about it when you know that where they came from, you know where they landed, and you know what they've done, and then you've seen the works that they published, so what's conspiratory about it? The books that are published on this subject. So, you know, I beg to disagree, but let's don't use this slogan. It's some sort of a conspiracy theory. Everything can be a conspiracy, but there are some facts that we cannot deny.
I think some people hear that. And, Corey, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think some people hear that, you know, these people fled Nazis. A lot of them were Jewish. It kind of flirts with some of the other conspiracy theories that people have about Jews dominate the world, that sort of thing.
I don't want to go in digress into that direction at all, because right now it doesn't have that ideology, doesn't have a religion to it, and let's keep it, you know, away from a religion, because it is a concept, a universal concept that was developed. It's scholars, and no one would deny it. That was actually, to be honest with you, actually, that institute in Frankfurt was initially called Marxist Institute, but they changed it because it didn't look good, so it's, they changed it, okay. But nonetheless, point to be made is that this is done at the highest level and permeated through the different levels of society, and right now, actually, it's at a kindergarten almost level.
All right, Corey, thank you for the call. Again, we'll leave listeners to make up their own minds about that. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us in the last bit of time we have. A couple of points. I do want to give you a little time to talk about some of your tax ideas, specifically as they relate to younger people and older people. Go for it. Briefly.
I wish I had a lot more time to explain it, because believe me, this is at the bottom of my heart. The seven pillars, and maybe what I should do, just to tell you, and the listeners I think deserve it, what they are. Abolishing taxes on real estate properties. Abolishing taxes on all Social Security income. Abolishing IRS taxes on retirement income. No federal taxes for individuals under age 23 and under 26 for full-time students or married couples. 5-year tax holiday for all new small businesses. Then free prescription drugs for seniors, disabled citizens, and veterans. And lately, last one, to restore dignity through hard work and ownership, I will work for you for free, pro bono publico, for the public good.
So okay, if you take away property taxes, if you take a big part of the tax base out with younger workers and older people's retirement income, and you do a 5-year tax holiday, how do you pay for the prescription drugs? How do you pay for schools, which are in Illinois, are largely funded by property
everybody
taxes?
Everybody does. But maybe I should also point something, and I will answer your question. The reason for this concept here that I have is to not so much take away money from the government, but save people's money, their own money. Taxes that you pay for real estate are their own out-of-pocket money. You know, all additional taxes that you pay they're deducted for Social Security, etc., they're all your own money. The same thing if you were to save 5 years on a new business or when you're younger. This is your own money. I'm not taking anybody else's money. Abolishing property taxes is probably the most challenging and difficult to accomplish. And I don't think it's going to be done with a stroke of a pen like the others may. This may take five, maybe even a decade to accomplish, but I think the idea behind it is that Siegel should universally be applied, and it should be done on federal level, because I don't believe at all, I don't think it's almost like a daylight robbery that people are, have to pay for their renting for their own house, so to speak, for themselves. And it needs to be done in small steps. At no time we can afford that schools or infrastructure will be abandoned. The interim programs that are developed, and we kind of a little bit touched upon it in volume number 5 in the August issue, because each of my bulletins identifies a specific pillar and in depth goes into it. Look at my website. You're going to find them. Right now we are at number 11, soon to be probably number 12. But what I'm trying to say is that we need to make sure at the end of the day that people are absolved from this burden of paying for taxes. And how we can accomplish it? Interim solutions are. But ultimately, we have to look by example like they've done in other countries, being in France or Germany. These are all developed countries. Poland.
Much higher income taxes in those countries, though.
I'm talking about property taxes. Yes, they have maybe a different tax system, but maybe on a federal level, we have to look carefully and initially establish even a special committee to look for alternative solutions. And we can learn from how it was done elsewhere so that we can come with a new system. It totally may be totally different from what it is. I don't think it should be done even at state level at all. And I think it's a federal issue that federal government should address it, because this is probably the equitable solution. If you are owner, you should not be responsible for paying for all schools, for all roads, and everybody else around you also participate.
Aren't those public goods, though? People would say, like, we all drive on the roads. Our fire trucks drive on the roads. We want educated people. We don't want people just drifting around, not without education. Why isn't that a public good?
Well, it is. It's a public good. So the entire public should be responsible for paying for it, not just selected group that owns something, that work all their life to make sure that they have a roof over their shoulder, and they are being literally penalized for, owning their own house by paying for infrastructure. Look at the bill. Maybe even pensions are being paid for certain, groups by your bill, that you're paying. This is not right. This is, I don't have a better term for this, but it's a highway robbery. People should be absolved from it, and there are countries around the world, and I showed you 3 countries that actually don't have property taxes or have reduced it, to minimum levels. So let's look at these examples. Let's establish a special commission. Look at alternatives to find a solution. But we need to let people go free. Let the owners go free. They are being penalized, and everybody is using, as you said, entire public is using why they could not contribute in some way by paying even taxes in a store for the products. Okay, so there are different ways of approaching, but let's look at it. It's a very difficult issue. I don't deny it, but we have to start somewhere. Initially, it's a concept. I know people all right away they ask me, well, how are you going to do this? Well, wait a minute. I don't have a staff of 100 people trained, economists, whatever. But let's look at it as an idea and take a look where it can go with the solutions that are already developed elsewhere.
All right, we are going to have to leave it there. Casey Chlebek is a candidate for the United States Senate running in the Republican primary in 2026. The election is coming up in March. Early voting begins this month. Different times at different places in Illinois. Check your local election authorities. If you want to hear other interviews in our conversation series, you can do so at our website, 21stshow.org. Mr. Chlebek, thank you for coming in today. Appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure to be on your airwaves. And thank you, people of Illinois, for listening to our conversation today. Thank you for the pleasant experience. I enjoyed it. And I am looking forward in the future to be here more often.
All right. Well, as I said, you can find more information and other interviews in this series at our website, 21stshow.org. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, coming up on the program, we are going to be talking about the weather. Enduring winter is a rite of passage in the Midwest. We'll talk about the stretch of really cold weather we've been enduring. But we're also seeing our changing climate giving us a new set of experiences. For better and worse, we'll try to make sense of Midwest winters, past and future. We also have other conversations in our Senate candidate series coming up. If you have questions for the candidates, you can always email us. talk@21stshow.org is the address. talk@21stshow.org. Visit our website. You can find information about other upcoming programs, past programs, and every other way to contact us. That is 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.